I was going to talk about comparative effectiveness in heart failure readmissions today, and part of the reason why was about this new project that we have here at UCLA that I thought I would let people know about. And so just in terms of what I thought I would talk about, I thought I would just give a very brief overview in terms of comparative effectiveness and the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which is funding this study, just so that people who may not necessarily know about some of the comparative effectiveness research that's going on, you know, just at least a brief overview. And then I thought I would go into some of the background for the study that we're doing, and then talk a little bit more about the study design, and specifically one of the, just the first aim, since it's a fairly complex study, and I figured that that's probably all we have time for just in this hour. And then just briefly touch on one of these methodologic issues that have come up in terms of how we're going to try to do comparative effectiveness for this study. So most people here probably do know that the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC, has or had $300 million of the $1.1 billion of stimulus funds set aside for comparative effectiveness research. And so of that $300 million, they dedicated a third of it to this Clinical and Health Outcomes Initiative and Comparative Effectiveness, and they just announced the awards about a week or so ago for 12 three-year awards. And so one of the awards is this $9.9 million award titled Variations in Care, Comparing Heart Failure Care Transition Intervention Effects, that technically started September 30th. That's based here at UCLA, although it involves the five UCs and Cedars-Sinai. And unfortunately, that's a very long name, and when we put the grant together, we couldn't come up with something better. So the team worked hard to come up with something shorter. Cardiologists are always very good in terms of coming up with nice acronyms. So they came up with this new title for the study called Better Effectiveness After Transitions, Heart Failure, the BEAT Heart Failure Study. So the other thing that I thought I would just briefly mention is the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. I know some people were talking a little bit earlier about how Gene Washington, our dean, is the chair for this new research institute. And so eventually, once it is ramped up, it'll have $750 million per year in funding in fiscal years 2013 to 2019, since it's a $2 tax on every insured individual, plus funds that are set aside. And so ARC is going to be one of the major distributors of funds and comparative effectiveness research. So again, you know, it's good to sort of get a sense of the things that ARC is funding. And just so that people know what they're defining as comparative effectiveness research, since I think in the last year, I think everybody underneath the sun has defined themselves as comparative effectiveness research, it's nice to see what is this actual statutory definition of comparative effectiveness research. And you can see here that it pretty much runs the gamut. So you can see that it's systematic reviews and assessment of existing and future research and evidence, primary research such as randomized clinical trials, which is what I'm going to describe here, molecularly informed trials, which I'm still not totally sure what that means, and observational studies, and then any other methodologies recommended by the methodology committee, which they're taking nominations now for. So with that as an overview, I thought I would just talk about our actual study, the BEAT Heart Failure Trial. And so to give everyone some background in
terms
of—
Can I ask you a question before you do
that? Go ahead, Bob.
What is the universe of options of how to reduce heart failure patients before you, unless you're going to put your trial in that universe?
In terms of how to reduce what?
Heart failure?
Well, the first issue in comparative effectiveness is that you, if you're going to really decide that you want to do it scientifically as opposed to riding a bicycle type, is what are the interventions that are key, and what do you think are the likelihood that they will succeed?
Sure.
What are the, as opposed to what you wound up at, and I just wondered what you didn't do as opposed to what you did do and what you considered on your plate before you decided to do what you did do.
Yeah, well, so I think I will actually go through that with
this. Oh,
yeah,
okay,
yeah. So, so I think that you know, there's certainly a wide variety of interventions that you can do to improve care for heart failure patients. But we decided to focus specifically on heart failure and this issue of readmissions. And so part of the reason why is because we know that heart failure is the medical condition most frequently associated with 30-day readmission for Medicare beneficiaries. And so if we're, you know, thinking of ourselves as taxpayers, you know, we have a vested interest in seeing if there's some way to reduce the readmission rate. So at least just for 30-day readmission rates, this is from the Jenks article from last year, that 30-day readmission rate is 26.9%. You can see that for basically all comers, for people who are hospitalized in Medicare, that 30-day readmission rate is 19.6%, so you know, it's definitely higher than what you would like to see. You know, and there are, again, some reasons why heart failure you know, tends to have a higher readmission rate. The other thing is that a lot of people believe that heart failure readmissions are potentially preventable, and that you know, people have estimated that about half of those are potentially preventable. And part of the problem is that a lot of people get readmitted without even getting any sort of follow-up care after they get discharged from the hospital. About, you know, half of the people get readmitted before that. So there's been a lot of focus on the period that happens right after you get discharged from the hospital. So there's this transition period between your discharge from the hospital and then when you get into outpatient care. And this, you know, there's a lot of literature that has focused around this called care transitions. And there have been several approaches that have actually been demonstrated in randomized controlled trials to reduce resource use by focusing on this care transition period. And so probably the most well-known model is the one that Mary Naylor has studied for many years called the transitional care model. And this is just some data about specifically heart failure in terms of reducing 30-day readmissions. You can see that for those who received her intervention, readmission rates were about 13% versus 26% for controls. There's another well-known model called the transition coach model, which is done by Eric Coleman out of Colorado, and the adjusted odds ratio for 30-day readmissions was 0.52 in his study in the Archives of Internal Medicine. And then there was a more recent study that was done by Brian Jack and other colleagues out at Boston Medical Center, where you know, they had an adjusted odds ratio for reducing 30-day readmission at 0.72, although it was sort of marginally significant. So, you know, while there's been a lot of talk about these models and potentially promulgating these models out, they're actually, you know, these models actually haven't been widely adopted. And part of the problem is that despite the fact that many of these studies demonstrate that they're cost effective for payers, so for example, if you're taking Medicare's perspective, they're cost effective, they're not, you know, those cost savings don't necessarily accrue to providers. Now, you know, certainly in healthcare reform, you know, there's been things that have been put into place that would potentially change that dynamic, which I think I also talk a little bit about later. But we know that there will be financial penalties for people who have, or for institutions where their hospital readmission rates exceed a certain threshold. You know, it's certainly going to be a lot higher initially, but at some point they will keep ratcheting it down. So I think that there's a lot of interest in terms of reducing readmission rates, particularly for heart failure, since this is one of the initial ones that they will be looking at. In terms of the actual costs for these programs, a large proportion of the costs actually are due to home care visits that are part of these program components. Now, I didn't want to spend a lot of time talking about what goes into every single one of these models, just briefly, in terms of Mary Naylor's model, what she has is an advanced practice nurse that will go into the hospital, follow patients that are hospitalized, and actually then follow them on the outside after they're discharged, you know, with fairly frequent home visits that go on for at least an average of 2 months, although if you look at some of the studies, they actually will follow patients out almost to a year. Now, there are certainly other models that do that. For example, our own heart failure clinic or our cardiomyopathy clinic also does that same type of model as well. But in terms of how they finance that, they're getting funds through different mechanisms. That's mostly focused on transplants, which are getting funds in a different way than what you would get from Medicare. For Eric Coleman's model, they also, you know, at least in the published version, there's at least one home visit that would occur from the advanced practice nurse that's associated with the program, and then they then do scheduled calls afterwards to continue to follow patients. And you can see that all these, you know, basically are tracking patients as they go outside of the hospital. The final model is this one by Brian Jack, and they actually don't use an advanced practice nurse. They use a pharmacist, and they did one post-discharge call, but, you know, in terms of looking how effective it, you know, it was in terms of reducing readmissions, not as effective, but, you know, you get the general sense that, you know, there's, you know, home visits may be more effective in terms of actually reducing readmissions or reducing resource use, but it comes at a certain cost. Some of these models have tried to use other types of providers, so they're not necessarily using advanced practice nurses. So a lot of people have used the transition coach model and tried to promulgate it using lower level providers. So for example, the California Healthcare Foundation funded some programs to try to use nursing students. There have been other places that have tried to use it in other ways, like, you know, can they use a health educator instead? So I think that everybody's looking to see if they can actually reduce the cost of these programs, but still, make them, relatively effective in terms of reducing readmissions.
Michael, can you talk about how each of those models, relate to or engage the PCP at all? Or if not the PCP, the cardiology team?
So in general, the advanced practice nurse coaches, at least for example in Eric Coleman's model, they're coaching the patient in terms of how to actually interact with the providers. And then also, if they realize that the patients are running into trouble, getting them back into care. So rather than depending on the individual patient themselves to say, I'm running into trouble, I need to schedule an appointment, they will try to help facilitate the patient getting back into the care system.
So that means scheduling a PCP appointment, but is there anything beyond that?
Potentially, but there's a wide range of different activities that they actually would do. They can certainly provide that information that they find in terms of going to the home care visit, back to the provider, to not just say, you need to come back and see your doctor, but this is all the things that we saw wrong. This is what's going on. So there certainly can be a higher level of engagement with all of these models. These are just one set of interventions that are out there. Again, they've been shown to be effective, but not well adopted. So, are there other options? And there certainly are. And so, people have looked into some of these other alternatives. And so, one alternative would be to use a telephone intervention without the home visit component. So, again, sort of following along that same model of having structured time points in terms of checking with the patient, going through a systematic approach in terms of saying, are you running into problems? What's going on with your medications? Are you gaining weight? And so this is a picture from the recent Cochrane review on this, where they just have some people on the phone. And then supposedly this is the call center that would get the information back and then transmit it back to who needs to hear about it, whether it's the outpatient, heart failure provider, or other individuals. The other option that people have talked about is telemedicine interventions with remote monitoring devices. And again, this comes from the recent Cochrane review. And so you can see here, generally for heart failure, this focuses on having a weight scale or a blood pressure device. Usually these are no longer wired directly to some sort of physical device. They can be placed anywhere, so you can put the scale in a bathroom rather than having it out where your phone connection is. So you can see that there's a little sub-top box here, so the information gets transmitted back there. It then goes through the internet or through some mechanism back to a server, which then goes to the care provider. If you have a nurse or a physician who can monitor that information, see if there are any sort of red flags that show up, and then that can result either in a call back to the patient, or other things, in terms of engaging other people to go out there. Like, for example, if it looks like there's a serious problem, they can call an ambulance to go out there. So in terms of the Cochrane review, this just came out in August, and they actually looked over 25 studies. So you can see that there have been about 16 telephone support studies and 11 telemonitoring studies. And these are the total number of patients involved with the studies, including both interventions and controls. And so in terms of all-cause mortality, telemonitoring seems to reduce all-cause mortality better than telephone support, but both of them seem to be sort of effective, although telephone support sort of crosses one in terms of its actual benefit for all-cause mortality. And when we look at all-cause hospitalization, you can see that the relative risk reduction is 0.9 for telemonitoring, and telephone support is 0.92. They do seem to be effective overall when we've been looking, generally at the studies that have been published. And again, given the publication lag, there again are more studies that are in the space that haven't been included in this Cochrane review, although this is the most recent one since it just came out in August. Now, in terms of heart failure related hospitalizations, obviously these interventions are very geared towards heart failure. And if you actually look at what causes heart failure patients to come back, it's not necessarily just heart failure, but you can see that they're much more effective in terms of actually reducing heart failure related hospitalizations. When we've looked at our own heart failure patients, you know, probably the number one cause for them to come back if you were going to take all diagnoses, the number one cause would probably be heart failure. But you know, again, there are other cardiovascular diseases that they have that they might come in for. Probably the next highest one, isolated by itself, is renal failure. Diabetes-related complications. So there's a whole panoply of things, and at least in some of the work that we've done. In terms of looking at cardiovascular-related rehospitalizations, it's about half. Half the time they're not coming back in for cardiovascular-related hospitalizations. The final thing is that in this Cochrane meta-analysis, there have been two head-to-head studies where they actually have looked at telemonitoring and telephone interventions, and they're not significantly different in terms of reducing rehospitalizations. Now, they've also looked at other outcomes. Some studies have looked at quality of life, and again, they show improvement in that, reduce healthcare costs, and are they acceptable? Are these devices things that they can use? And generally, they find that it ranges anywhere from 60% to 95% acceptability for using these sort of telemonitoring devices. So that's one broad overview of sort of the space that's out there in terms of looking at different approaches to working on readmissions. And then I just briefly wanted to talk about the other reason why we were very interested in looking at this particular topic, which is around heart failure and variations.
Before you do,
sure.
I'm really now going to ask a question. What would you do next in this field? You have all the money in the world. What the heck would you do next in the field? I think you got to answer that question. So what I would do next is pay Catherine $400,000 a year and tell Catherine that she should keep every one of these patients out of the hospital forever. And I will bet you that $100 to penny that she could do it. There's no reason for any of these people ever to see the hospital again. If they get sick enough that they need to be in the hospital, they should be on palliative care, be on hospice, and they should be all home. And she can do everything at home for them. And the reason or you can take another argument that says, it doesn't matter which of these things you implement. Implement something now across the country. Why study it anymore? I mean, you can save one-third of the total emissions. If you do even these kind of mediocre interventions reasonably, why aren't you doing it?
So I think that the one thing that would be helpful in terms of understanding what we should do next, because I agree that, and I think that in general with the way that healthcare reform has moved, we're going to be putting the onus in terms of keeping people out of the hospital onto providers. But in terms of trying to find, if we continue to move into the space of, having accountable care organizations where we're, again, putting more management responsibilities away from, let's say, the payers and trying to engage providers to do more management directly, then at some point you just have to figure out, well, what is the best way to do it? What is the best mousetrap that we can build in order to get those numbers all the way down to zero? Because I agree. I mean, I think that in terms of readmissions for heart failure, for people who are...
What's failure?
So
it's a single emission. I mean, it's a single emission, and I'm not just doing this to be.
No. I think that this is a debate that's been going on
For heart failure patient. What's your goal? What are you really trying to do? Are we trying to figure out? So, having spent hours talking to Mary Naylor about her work, she did something that was as aggressive as the University of Penn, this bastion of poor care, would allow her to do. Okay, and it was effective. But it was as best as she could do. But nobody has really said, let's do something that's worthwhile doing. And she spent 20 years of her life, slugging through all this stuff. And so are we gonna wait another 20 years to compare some other stuff while we do absolutely nothing? And so the question is, what really ought to be done here? What commitment should UCLA have? What should the control group look like, is what I'm really asking.
So that is a good question, and that's part of the methodological issue that I'm going to raise.
Well, it's not a methodological issue, it's a moral and ethical issue of what we mean that, if you're going to get all this money, what should the control group actually look like?
So not to totally cut away to the last slide, but you know, if you look at some of the other sites, they've already implemented these models. And so in terms of looking at what we do here at UCLA, we're definitely behind. You know, we're not doing anything. Now, we're not the only ones that are not doing anything, but, you know, and again, the other thing is that, you know, I was at a meeting last week where there were, you know, a number of other medical centers around the country, and, you know, one medical center said, we have 12 interventions to try to reduce readmissions, and particularly in heart failure. And to the best of our knowledge, none of them are effective. So, you know, what about their particular interventions are not working? You know, again, everybody sort of knows that, you know, you if you really closely monitor these patients, you should be able to reduce readmissions. Now, you know, to what standard? You know, should it just be reduced, you know, so that it's a 30% reduction? You know, should it be, you know, should it be something where we reduce it all the way down to zero? Again, that's, I think, a debate that nobody, you know, that has been, you know, tossed around a lot in terms of saying, should the optimal rate be, you know, somewhere around 2%, you know, which, you know, some people think are achievable versus, you know, just looking for that short-term reduction of just saying, we can do this with, you know, getting heart failure readmissions down another 30%, so we're no longer at 25%, but we're somewhere down in space of 15, 16%. So it's a good question, Bob, and I don't think that there's a great answer. I mean, my personal feeling is that we should be reducing this down to zero, and we should find the most effective ways of doing it at the least amount of cost.
In the infection issue, mm-hmm. It is absolutely the case now that with cost-effective mechanisms, there should be no infections in ICUs anymore from central lines, zero.
Yeah.
It's now been demonstrated in 3 or 4 places, and nobody wants to do it. It really has, and it should be none if people actually wash their hands and put in the lines the way they're supposed to be put in. I mean, and so there are a number of places now that have done this. Okay. So, and people now are arguing, should we, I mean, and I, look, we can go look at those places and see if it's all fake, but the question is, what, with this amount of money, I mean, what is your goal here? At the end of this, in what time period? Because you know, once this money is gone, there is going to be no money.
Yeah.
So the real goal is, what do you really expect, and what do you really want? And that's why I'm being tough, because this is the one shot that one's going to have to do this.
Yeah. Well,
and you spend a lot of time talking about cost, and as far as I can tell, cost is not even allowed to be captured in this work.
So the good thing about our study was that we submitted it before the healthcare legislation got set into stone. So we actually do measure a cost in the study, and it is one of the aims for this particular study, so that we will actually measure the cost effectiveness. But that was probably the one shot that we had in terms of getting, because, you know, in terms of where, you know, cost is now and, you know, patient-centered outcomes research, it's, you know, pretty much off the table. So, you know, we do have a shot at looking at that. But I think that in terms of, you know, what can we do, you know, I think that, you know, Mary Naylor's model is a great model, you know, and I think that it points to what is really important in terms of reducing readmissions and, you know, improving care overall. But the problem is that in healthcare, if we keep throwing physical people at a solution, people are an expensive solution. And if there's a way to find ways to automate it, so for example, just like a checklist, you know, in terms of looking, you know, how can we reduce, you know, hospital-acquired infections in the ICU? If there is a systematized way of doing it that, you know, doesn't need to involve an individual where it can be automated, it can be very reliable, that's probably the kind of solutions that we would want.
Okay, so in summary, what you want to do is take the work that's been done and modify the interventions and obtain about the same level of success that they have.
At least.
Do it much cheaper.
That's right. So that's the ultimate goal for this
by replacing Catherine with a robot.
Yes. I went to medical school.
I've tried to do that for a long time.
I went to medical school with this guy who said that the future was RoboDoc. You know, all we need to do is just put a little happy visual on the computer. And actually, Brian Jack's group out in Boston Medical Center has this.
Google and build a car that can actually do this.
That's right.
And, you know, drive the car part of it without the driver to the house with heart failure. Have a robot and do the whole thing together.
Well, you know, I think that the thing is that. You know, if we can use the highly skilled professionals that we have in the healthcare system to focus on that sort of stuff and to not have to do busy work or things that, you know, can be automated or systematized, that's going to make our system much more efficient. And, you know, if anything, that's how we're more likely to at least maintain the standards that we have, if not improve them, as well as try to reduce down costs. At least that's my view on this, but and we'll find out in the study as we go through it. So I can probably skip over this really quickly, just because I know it's already 12:30. But basically, just to let you know, obviously we've been looking at heart failure and variations for a while with the six sites that we've been working with, and so I don't think we need to go into this in a lot of detail. But we also see that there's variation on readmission rates, and this is just from our 2001 to 2005 data, where basically at least at 180 days, the rates varied between 33% to 46%. It's a lot lower if you're looking at 30-day readmission rates for these six particular medical centers, where it was 14% to 20% in terms of the variation for any cause readmission back to these medical centers. Now this is obviously going to be higher because this is just looking at the data that we can capture at our own sites. When we've looked at Medicare data, we know that this rate is higher. So the other thing that we did to make sure that we wanted to focus on the right space, we wanted to try to find ways to reduce the variation that we still see. Because despite all the press about the article that we did, that came out last year, the bottom line is there's still variations between all the six sites. The magnitude of the variation might be a little bit different, but there's still variation. And I think that ultimately, we want to find ways to reduce unnecessary variation. So we actually conducted a short organizational survey of heart failure care at the six sites last year. And so we used Harlan Krumholtz's taxonomy of heart failure interventions to try to get a sense of how effective these interventions really are. Because it's one thing to say that you have an intervention on the books, but that doesn't mean that it's actually being implemented. And so only one of the six sites actually had any type of comprehensive activity for all heart failure patients. What we have at UCLA is a comprehensive approach for those patients that are on the transplant list or that have received heart transplants, but everybody else is left out to the hole. And that was pretty much the case at all sites. And if we look back at that time period in 2001 to 2005, we also know that basically nothing was going on. The only reason why they had this comprehensive activity was because they got 2-year grant funding to do it. Ultimately what we're also interested in is can care transition interventions reduce the variation between the sites? Because we know that this is the one area that interventions have been shown to reduce both mortality and resource use, but we don't really know if the unobservable variation is due to variation in care transition activities at these different medical centers. And so in addition to trying to find the better mousetrap, we also want to see if this is actually going to change the variation between the medical centers. So in terms of the actual study design, this is just the project team, a lot of familiar faces on here. You can see the six sites, but a lot of health services researchers are the site PIs. At every place we have a clinical lead that's a cardiologist, with the exception of UC San Francisco, where their heart failure service is largely run by the hospitalists. And then you can see that there are others, with different types of expertise that have been brought onto the project for various reasons, which we don't need to go into at this time, but happy to talk about it later. But in terms of the specific aims for this particular study, these are the three specific aims. The first one was to compare the effect of two separate care transition interventions with concurrent controls on variation in readmissions among elderly patients hospitalized with heart failure at the six sites. And then we also wanted to examine the change in variation over time in readmissions and mortality among the hospitalized Medicare beneficiaries with heart failure at the six sites, just because if we're just looking at our own patients, we're not necessarily going to know what's happening. If you're just going to squeeze one end of the balloon and you're just going to send all the readmissions out other hospitals, that's not really solving anything. And then finally, we wanted to compare the health benefits and costs of the two separate care transition interventions. So I just wanted to focus specifically on aim one, just because that's pretty much the meat of the actual intervention. And you can see that the first care transition program is one that's largely based on existing models, but modified to reduce costs. And the two ways that we thought that we could reduce costs from those existing care transition models was to substitute the planned home care visits with planned or structured telephone mononitoring calls. And then, if you think about it, that's certainly one way to reduce costs, but if you end up having six medical centers that each have a separate call center, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think that in terms of the chronic disease management literature, what we have often seen is that people tend to load on multiple conditions onto telephone management just because you don't have a high enough volume to make it work out financially. So rather than try to combine it with multiple conditions, which loses some fidelity, oftentimes when I've seen other models, for example, where they've lumped depression care with asthma care, one condition usually gets the short shrift. And so to try to maximize what we would get out of this sort of structured telephone management, we wanted to centralize the telephone monitoring for all six sites. The other program is this care transition program with remote monitoring, and this substitutes planned home care visits and telephone monitoring calls with remote monitoring, and then just rather than structured telephone follow-up from the centralized call center, as needed calls from the centralized call center. Because you know there are going to be some people who you are monitoring who probably are going to be fine, who don't necessarily need a dedicated one-hour phone call to go over everything when patient is compliant with medications, doing fine, not running into any trouble. And then the final arm is usual care. So in terms of the study design, in terms of what we thought our overall N would be for the study, we figured out that there'd be about 1,700 patients or so at the 6 medical centers that would meet the enrollment criteria, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And that from that we estimated that obviously some people were not going to want to participate in the study, but that we would have about 1,500 patients over an 18-month period at the 6 sites, and that we would split these up into three arms, equally distributed in terms of 500 patients in each arm. Now, in terms of how this study would compare to the other studies that have been done, this would probably be the second largest study out there for telephone monitoring. So there's only one trial that was larger in terms of that was included in the Cochrane review, looking at structured telephone calls without any home visit component. Because there's certainly been a lot of different programs that have been out there, but they're often multidisciplinary, multifaceted, and so many of them have included home care as part of their interventions. But to do something purely just structured telephone management, there haven't been as many studies. In terms of the telemedicine component, certainly there have been a lot of studies that have been out there, but this would certainly be the largest study.
Michael, do you have any idea what the heck causes remissions in these people? Let me ask you what I think it causes them. They run out of money. They have no electricity. They, even though you're using university people, they can't pay for their meds. The person that is taking care of them is burnt out.
So,
what I don't know, did you collect any clinical data, grab a fellow and go out there and just interview 25 people who presume have some skills still left in clinical care and actually try to figure out what the hell's going on here?
I think that there are a lot of reasons why people get readmitted. And I think that some of the issues that you've raised certainly come up with people as well, in terms of it's not just the one individual. Obviously there are caregivers that are involved, and if the caregivers are not around, people start running into trouble, that's a big problem. And I think that while this is one approach to reducing readmissions, obviously with Manel on the back, I think that even with the recent trial that came out on self-management that everybody probably saw in JAMA last month, that said that self-management wasn't any better than education. I think that the real thing that I gleaned from that particular study is that when you look at the subpopulation that was low income, that actually was the group that was close to significance in terms of self-management actually being better than just pure education alone in terms of heart failure management.
I'm not asking about education. I'd like to know what is the root cause of the readmission. I'm not talking about the intervention. I mean, do we really, if somebody really got out and done a qualitative 100 people when they get readmitted, what is really going on here? Was it that, I really don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, the assumption that you have here is that the medical care processes weren't followed carefully. And so when people had increased weight, they didn't get their diuretics adjusted. When their diabetes went out of control because their organs were getting dry, they didn't get caught early enough. I mean, that's the assumption, that it's bad, that we need more rapid biological improvement in monitoring. And the studies have shown if you do that on a general population, you can reduce some difference. But do we really know what's going on here?
I think it's really hard to say. So, for example, I was just on service last month. We had a heart failure patient who came in exacerbation, was cared for by a cardiologist here, sees one of our geriatricians on a very frequent basis. Why did she, get hospitalized? She ended up getting hospitalized, on one hand, when you first, have them come into the hospital, all you see are the list of medications. You just know that there's a heart failure exacerbation. You go through the whole thing, check their ejection fraction with an echocardiogram. Bottom line was that she, was off on her own, non-compliant with her diet. and was, you know, just eating more salty food because her family was not around to monitor her situation as closely. After we got her plugged back into care, all these issues started coming out. But I think that...
What does it mean she was plugged back into care? It sounds like she didn't seem care frequently. You mean you got her family back in touch?
Yeah, so we contacted her primary care doctor, contacted her cardiologist to get a better sense of what's going on. Because it's one thing to ask the patient, like, what happened? The patient just basically says, I was doing fine, and then I just ran into trouble. And so you do need some, somebody has to go and do that root cause analysis to find out what actually is going on. And, in this particular case, this patient, the primary care doctor contacted the family to get a better sense of what was going on. Family, was not around at the time, had seen her primary care doctor probably within the past month. These sort of things can happen, relatively rapidly, depending on what their status of heart failure is. But at some point, there needs to be some type of monitoring or, occasionally, there can be deviations from the path. People live their lives. These things happen. But what you need is some type of course correction or some type of way to check in with people to say, is there, if you're running into trouble, what can we do to avert total system failure and have you come back into the hospital? Because that's a total failure in terms of our care. If the patient has to come into the hospital when there's something that was preventable, that's a failure.
So the studies that have been done about unintended pregnancies tend to argue that women really do know how to prevent unintended pregnancies, even poor women. But there are other reasons for making that happen. And I don't get anything from the story you told me that you have any understanding of this person at all, to be blunt. There's a whole new movement in primary care, which basically says if you don't spend more than an hour, at least an hour, in these patients with an hour, trying to talk about what's really bothering them, relationships, really form a relationship, go out and visit them, that you can't be their doctor. Now, I don't know whether that's true at all either, but you don't give me any insight. I mean, I could just as easily, from what you said this is a person that was trying to kill herself. Her life's not worth living. She was trying to kill herself. She chickened out at the end. And finally, her breathing got too difficult, her weight, or she couldn't get out of bed, or somebody noticed her, and tried to rescue her again, and she didn't have enough macho-ness to say, no, I really was trying to kill myself, and nobody's really had a conversation about that. I mean, there's no understanding there of the patient, and I'm just wondering, this is a lot of money to spend. It would be really great as part of it if somebody really could understand what's going on here.
I think that part of the reason why, for example, Mary's model uses this person who follows the patient in and out of the hospital is to build that therapeutic relationship. And I think that the way that our care systems are set up, there's no way to really know, right? I mean, you have to have somebody who really knows that person really, really well. And even this type of system is not going to, be as good as, having somebody who knows that person intimately.
So a readmission rate, does an attending who's a good clinician at UCLA for a heart failure patient that comes in sit down and spend 2 hours talking to the patient about all of these things? I mean, not to the primary care doctor, not to anything, but actually sits down and says, and tries to explore all the facets of this, what their wishes are, what's going on. And I'm not trying to be critical. I'm trying to say, would you come up with a different intervention than trying to vary telephones with telemeds, with controls, and Patrick now wants to give a whole medicine kit that's going to replace both of you. He's going to do it in real time, and by the time this is out, he's going to be 9 years ahead of you. The bottom line is that, gadgets are gadgets. And what I'm really asking is there any basically, the front page article in Time Magazine was a stop. Just think, you have to put in Time Magazine a doctor that sits there in Stanford and says he's going to be teaching again how to do a physical exam.
Yeah, Abraham.
And that's front page news. Yeah. I mean, so the question is, I'm really serious. Does anyone really understand anything about this?
Well, what I would say is that, I think that in general, we are over-professionalized in healthcare. I mean, even the scenario that you've described in terms of having the attending physician go over to the patient, spend those 2 hours, I don't think that we necessarily need to have the attending physician do that. I mean, we probably could have somebody who knows a lot about heart failure that is not necessarily somebody who, went through 4 years of medical school, who went through 3 years of residency training to physically go through and do that. We probably could find somebody who could do it a lot more inexpensively and still do it just as well. And I think that those are the kind of solutions that we need to look for. Now, whether that's somebody who can be substituted in terms of a physical device, You know, I think that a physical device can certainly get us to some point, but you know, I would say that in terms of that human interaction, it's not going to be replaceable. I think that the big question is, you know, what would this device compared to, or let's say, these sort of telephone management interventions look like if we were going to, let's say, do something like Tim Garson, who's coming on Friday, you know, if we're going to use, you know, very, you know, very savvy elderly people who are, you know, sort of retired and don't need a lot of income to do this. So I think that in terms of coming up with overall approaches to try to change the way that our healthcare system is working, I think that we just need a fundamental shift in terms of what kinds of people are we asking to do the different kinds of care things that we are sort of saying are standards of care. And whether that's, you know, whether that's going to be a technological solution, whether it's going to be some other type of solution, I mean, the ultimate thing is we just need to find some way to lower the costs.
Killing them is easy, right?
Well, that's true too, but short of that.
I
just wanted to add something. Since I'm helping Dr. Maureen eventually to go out and meet with the patients, and then when I'm actually talking with them in the hospital about the remote device and I show them the apparatuses, a lot of the patients are actually relieved to be able to go home with a scale because some of them don't have a scale. A lot of them don't have blood pressure cuffs, so they actually been really helping about receiving those items, you know, because they don't have the money to pay for it themselves. And it's been interesting just talking with them because a lot of them don't know what their blood pressure normally is. They don't know what their heart rate normally is. They're not watching their diet, like you said. They might get in trouble by having more salt one day. So in just discussing it with them, a lot of them are really enthusiastic to participate because they feel like if they live especially far away from the hospital, they feel like they'll be in touch with the hospital and someone's kind of looking at their data and, you know, like Lorraine would make a friendly phone call just to see how they're doing. And I think it's just empowering the patients to be more self-reliant and also just to know their own physical characteristics better. And so I think the monitoring devices are fantastic for that, because then it's like my 95-year-old grandma, if I called her right now, I know she wouldn't know her blood pressure, she wouldn't know her heart rate, she, you know, she doesn't really pay attention. But if I was to say, hey, take your weight every day, let me know how you feel, I think people pick up on what their normal baseline is. And then they can act more by saying, oh, my blood pressure is higher. Wait, I better not have those potato chips. And, you know, I think it just helps. Not only does it give us data, but it provides themselves the data. That's something that I think in the healthcare we might know what our normal blood pressure is, but a lot
yeah.
of people don't.
Well, I think the one thing that I would also say, though, is that it's not, you know, a lot of these studies have been done in people who are fairly high functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not, you know, if we were going to disseminate this out to people who are of low income, you know, of you know, lower educational status, you know, are they really going to be able to use these sort of devices? I mean, it's, you know, if I were going to get a device, I'd be very happy, you know, but I don't think that that's necessarily for everybody. And I think that this is part of the reason why we're doing the study, to find out what happens if we just, you know, give to basically every heart failure patient that comes into the hospital. I know that we're sort of short on time. Basically, we're just, you know, taking people with basically age 55 and over. And so the exclusion criteria is obviously, you know, some of them are a little bit more obvious than others. Patients with dementia, you know, it's a little difficult for them to comply. Patients who are discharged to skilled nursing facilities are going to a more structured system of care, although that's probably not really the case. Patients without a working telephone, if they can't physically get a call, that's a problem. We also talked about taking out the transplant patients just because they're plugged into a different system of care. And then also outside transfer patients, although I think that this is an issue that we're potentially going to rediscuss. And part of the reason why we didn't want to include outside transfer patients is because they often are coming in with a much higher severity, but there's also an issue in terms of what system of care are they plugged into. If they're coming in from somewhere else where we don't actually know their doctors very well, but we probably will revisit that one. I think that we don't necessarily need to go through exactly what the protocols are. Happy to share them with everybody at some point.
What is the minimum? I still want to know, what is the minimum? What is the standard? If I was on the IRB, I would not approve this, given this data that has been published in literature, because what is the minimum standard? You can't use a control that has nothing. We've just proven in the literature, you did a Cochrane analysis to show this is an unethical study. As far as I'm concerned, if UCLA does not provide a heart failure patient scale at this moment, and the minimum level that's in there, what is the minimum level that that you're using? You're going back and doing control. It's like treating 160 over 105 blood pressures without medication as a control group. It's not ethical.
So, you know, the problem with this is that, and let me just skip ahead to this because we don't really need to go through any of this part, but I mean, the problem is that there are all these other concurrent interventions that are going on with heart failure and readmissions because everybody is worried about this. So everybody is trying to find some way to give patients a scale, to give people a phone call back. You know, and again, as I mentioned, you know, there's a high degree of interest in this. And, you know, not only have we come up with this issue of what everybody is doing to try to, you know, again, get everybody up to this, what we would think is the right standard of care, there's a whole another issue of duplication of services where, you know, for example, you know, we know at one site, you know, people are getting 5 phone calls in 3 days, you know, so.
Michael, I had a prostate operation in this institution. Should I have been sent home without the ability to wash out my catheter when it would get clogged so I can scream for a few hours? Lots of people in this room would have liked that to happen. Now, the question is, what is the minimum standard of care that, I'm being serious, that a modern-day hospital that's putting people in a private room that overlooks the mountains of Los Angeles that cost $1.5 billion to build, what's the standard of care at discharge against which you will run something better? If I told a pediatric oncologist you can't treat leukemia because we want to test this against nothing, they would turn to me and say, it's unethical. So I'm really asking, how did you come up with a standard of care? If you just say usual care at this moment, you know, I worry about that.
Well, I have to say that usual care is really a moving target in this because, again,
okay,
you
so
know.
So what is usual care at the worst hospital in your system?
So I would say that usual care generally comes down to giving people instructions to follow what their weight is, gives people instructions about what medications you're on, tries to do the reconciliation to make sure that your medications are the same as they were on the outside, tries to make sure that you're going to get back in to see a doctor within about 7 days to make sure that you don't run into any sort of trouble.
I know something very specific. If they don't have a scale, there's one provider. Did somebody weigh them on a scale that they're going to use at home so that they have an idea what their weight is? Do they have specific instructions about what to do? I mean, I could tell you that, having been followed a cancer patient discharged from this hospital after a Whipple's procedure, and she goes home, and I call her up, and she's vomiting and nausea. She got a card to go to the nutritionist on the cancer patient because she got discharged on Friday afternoon, and person wasn't here. So why did you call on Monday or Tuesday if you're bobbing up your guts for the 3 days because the doctor told you to go out on a regular diet? That's considered really good care. Now, the bottom is that I don't really understand what, in this study, I mean, what is going to be the baseline minimal care? I mean, and then about doing it. Or, I mean, I would have no problem comparing the sophisticated telemetry group, different levels of providers doing this, but I really worry about a usual care program that's broke compared to the literature.
So, my feeling, Bob, is that, probably in the next year or so, probably all these sites are going to be doing those exact same things because we're not going into the study tomorrow or anything like that. We're going into the field a year from now. So in terms of what is going to be that standard of care when the patients actually are going to be compared against telephone monitoring or telemedicine monitoring, all these sites, have an opportunity to get us up to that right level that we would expect. Because I agree that if the patient doesn't have a weight scale, they should have one. I mean, that's not a very expensive proposition for any medical center to provide. Whether or not we can transform the way that our nursing services currently operate in terms of giving patients that appropriate kind of care, that's something that I think is constantly evolving. I think that almost every other medical center, with the exception of ours, is already doing that. Then it really just comes down to what are we doing at UCLA? Because right now, in terms of our readmission numbers, we're probably the best. And my guess is that given where we are in terms of what we do for the standard of care versus what all these other medical centers are doing to try to raise up that level of care, we're probably going to be at the bottom. But in terms of what the standard of care is now, I mean, part of the reason why, I would expect, some of the work that Mary did and other people, what was that standard of care then is exactly what you're describing now. At this point, I think that we sort of know what works. And if you want to really try to reduce the readmission rate, these are the things that you would need to do. So the problem is that, while we see that, the Cochrane Review suggests that these, things are effective, what were they compared against, right? I mean, if they're compared against basically just throwing somebody out to the wind, well, of course you're going to be more effective, right? I mean, just even having a simple phone call is going to be better than that. But I think that in terms of what we will actually see when we go into the field, given that everybody is focused on heart failure and readmissions, we're probably going to see that that level of care is going to be totally different in terms of what the control group is going to be. Yes?
Pardon me for the sneezes, the hot peppers up the wrong way. as I'm listening to the 2D dialogue, it seems that there's the study, and on one side there's the NAVA study, which is kind of like a Cadillac version. You want to scale this down to see if something less expensive can be as effective. And there's usual care where it's not really well standardized, and you want you right in the middle. And in terms of the NAVA approach, I wanted to let you know that there's a person named Barry Wellman. He's very well known for doing research comparing face-to-face interactions versus telephone interactions, and in what instances you can obtain certain kinds of help and data, and that might help you to think through the Cadillac versus the telephone-mediated exchanges.
Sure, that's very helpful. Thanks. I'll follow up with you on that. So in any case, so you know, that's sort of the bottom line. I mean, I think that in terms of, you know, it's one thing to do a study and spend all this time. And, you know, I have to say that on one hand, you know, I think that it's going to be great that, you know, we will gain more experiences in terms of using some of these other types of monitoring devices. Whether this is really going to demonstrate a true effect when the, you know, what has been considered the control group in the past is going to totally change by the time that we even get out in the field, it's going to, you know, I have to say that, you know, if I were the funders, I'm not sure that, you know, if they knew that healthcare reform was really going to pass, that they would have funded the study. Because I think that with all the things that are now in healthcare reform, you know, again, when you have a moving target, it's one thing to make decisions, and, you know, sometimes you have to make decisions ahead of time before you know what's actually going to happen. But, you know, I think that in, you know, where this is now, and given how much movement and momentum there is in heart failure and readmissions, I think that things would be a lot different today, and they would have asked us to do a different type of study design.
And the last question on, we know where the readmissions occur, question spot six. Why would you concentrate on university hospitals as opposed to where the problem is? Is it the alcoholic and the drunk and that kind of stuff? But I mean, if the real problem, if you're spending $10 million to improve something, and you know that you know something, and you know all the geographic variations, why wouldn't you go there? Who cares whether UCLA is a 1% or 10% higher readmission rate than UC Irvine, other than the CEOs of both places? The real problem is, what are you going to do in the four communities?
Well, so I think that in terms of, you know, if you were going to go out directly into SPA 6, I mean, it would be good to know for sure, you know, how things work with other individuals before going into that. Because I think that, you know, spreading this out even further, you know, in terms of these approaches, if they're demonstrated to be effective, would make a lot of sense. Because I think that, you know, we would definitely want to work on where all the action actually is. But I think that, you know, in terms of testing it in an environment where we know that we can control things better is probably a good start. And then the second thing is that by promulgating these sort of models in a place that technically does training, although again, you know, training by, you know, observing is not necessarily the best way to train somebody how to do things, but if, you know, if we can train other individuals so that, you know, when they go out into practice, you know, if they're going to go out into practice in SPA 6, that they have familiarity with these types of models of care, you know, that'll actually set the environment up to make these even more successful in a place like SPA 6. So, so anyways, I know I skipped over a lot of materials, but I know that it's sort of 1 o'clock now, so I figured I'd just check in and see if anybody had any questions and kind of go from there.
I've got to run to another meeting, but I'd love to talk to you about using Skype, because I think in that group there's a big difference between the phone, where my mother won't even hear you on the phone, and seeing, you know, I think there's this dichotomy between devices that are impersonal and having that interaction. I know it, you know, requires having a computer access, but I think that might be really nice. And you don't have to have the advanced care nurse there for all of it. You can do a lot of the data collecting. But nice talk.
Thanks. Ron?
A lot of the things Bob was saying seems to come down to, like, assuming people are motivated just that something happens and goes wrong versus maybe they actually don't want to follow-up recommendations or something else going on. And he was suggesting you do qualitative stuff, and you never did say you would do it if you're writing a study. But given you think the study's really maybe not the right design now anyway, is there any chance to change it, and not just that way, but also in finding out when you actually went ahead with it, what the different causes are, so that for the future, you know, whether this is the most effective way to go about changing it or not?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that to get to the issue of, you know, what's actually going on with the patients, I mean, it's one thing just to sort of like throw out the devices, but, you know, we actually have structured time points when we're going to check back in with each of the patients to find out what is going on with them. In terms of like informal caregiving, at some point, you know, in terms of other things like comorbidities, are they depressed? You know, how much is that playing a role in terms of what they're doing? I think that there are going to be ways that we might be able to potentially get at that, not necessarily in a qualitative way, but in terms of other types of ways where we might be able to find associations that might suggest that it's really, you know, the people who are, let's say, you know, severely depressed who are not you know, who are getting
rehab. Why are you using Mrs. Covariates as opposed to designing the intervention to be flexible to use these things as ways of personalizing the intervention? You see, what I'm really worried about is that, that's what I've been trying to say. I mean, instead of saying that, let's say you're going to produce an odds ratio and a multivariate analysis at the end that's 1.01 and significant at the p.0 level and shows health literacy is worse, and you'll write a paper about it. Why? Why not, you know, jump on this up front and actually figure out, is there a way of modifying your intervention so it's not standardized for everybody in the cohort? If you're on 20 medicines as opposed to 5 medicines, mm-hmm. and you really need those 20 medicines, I mean, does this intervention have to be different than if you're on 5 medicines? A good doctor would do all this in this way. Depending on your end of life wishes, you would change what you're doing. I mean, every one of these things could be part of an individualized protocol.
So I think that the difficult part about the individualized protocol is that, on one hand, I mean, we could do it and demonstrate that it was effective. I think that the hard thing would then be, well, which parts were actually the most effective parts of it? And so I think that, you know, that's part of the reason why I put this up here, because the main thing that we're actually looking at are some of these other types of measures that we want to see, you know, some of the things that people have talked about in terms of really critical issues during this care transition period. Are these the things that really matter the most, or are they something else?
But you know the answer to that question. The answer to the question is just like the surgeons found out, that you got to do all of the processes correctly. If you do the history and physical great for pneumonia and get 90 points out of 100, you don't give the antibiotics, the person ain't going to do it. If somebody comes back and they don't have the other things done, so you know in medicine that this difficult of a patient, that you really have to really do this. It wouldn't have been that hard. If it was this easy to do, we would have done it with very simple techniques. We're not all kind of dopes, so we would have done this. So what you're really talking about is there a way of tailorizing an individual thing that takes advantage of their geography, their socioeconomic status, their medical status, their comorbidities, their wishes, to actually achieve the goal that you want to do? And you're gonna, it has to be complicated. It's not gonna be easy. And what I'm really worried about is at the end of this, you're gonna put a lot of work into this, and, you know, it's going to show stuff that is publishable and probably interesting. But, I mean, it's not working on the real problem. If you have a really good doctor like you that is going to attend, and you're going to be there, and you get a heart failure patient at UCLA, I mean, and you really want to do state-of-the-art care, what is it?
So what I would say, Bob, is that with regards to this particular intervention, you know, what we're hoping for is that all those qualitative answers in terms of what actually is going on, that's actually part of the intervention. So I mean, the reason why there is a structured telephone component is because there is actually a structured interview that has to go into that is going to say, what is going on with you? Why did you run into trouble? What are sort of the things that we can do to change the situation for you? What sort of care do you actually?
I'm all for this, and you're doing great work, and I'm sorry. But, you know, the things that stick in my mind are the reporters. They go back and back to people. And finally, by when they have some trust, they actually get what happened. What really was why the girl who was 14 decided to get pregnant. What really is going on? I remember that Rand Rouse, these may just be in recollections of an ugly old fart, but there was a 13-year-old patient, smart as hell, Latino, who had her heart stopped beating twice because of asthma. And the discussion at the Grand Rounds here was all about, that we should have seen the medicine, she should have gotten back and all of this kind of stuff. And I was listening, and she was there, and I was listening to her, and I finally said to her, I don't understand any of this. What really happened here? What's going on? Tell me, you're smart, you're brilliant. You knew you had symptoms starting 8 hours ago. You knew what happened last time. Having a cardiac arrest can't be fun. I mean, what happened? And then she tells the story of all of you charging her parents $25 a month, and that they couldn't get shoes, they couldn't get anything, and charging her $25 a month, and her parents had signed to that because they were too rich to get whatever was the program at the time. And had nothing to do with the getting back an hour. I don't know whether any of this is true here, or what's going on. I didn't want to call my son to help me. I've been bothering them. They got into a fight. Something happened. I don't know what's going on here, but it's got to be hard. And I don't know how much money we should spend at doing this. But I really would love. I mean, you have the opportunity to really understand this. And when you got a who's list of health services researchers, you have enough fellows running around that it would seem a shame not to really understand what's going on with these people and take the effort to really try to figure out what really is happening,
yeah,
as opposed to a multivariate analysis.
Well,
now, I'm all for multivariate analysis.
Well, so my feeling is that I would be all for having more people working on this project to help us get to the answer. And I think that the other thing is that I think that in terms of building those sort of trust and relationships, in terms of that kind of information coming out, that's something that can't happen in a one-time phone call, which is the reason why I think that the Brian Jack model is not a good model. Because I think that at some point, it really comes down to that personal interaction you're going to have. Now, can you have it like with Mary Naylor's program where you have the same nurse following you out there? Yes. But how do you do that in a way that may not necessarily need all those different components? And, whether this is really going to work in terms of having the same sort of, because the centralized call center is basically two people that are going to be working with the same people over a six-month period. Are they really going to be able, in a structured way, get to those answers? Because it's not going to happen in a one-time phone call. It's probably going to have to, those answers are going to come out, several calls down the line. So I think that in terms of getting those sort of real answers out, I mean, even with all the people that are associated with the study now, we need more help in terms of really getting to that real answer. And I think that in terms of the qualitative information, we certainly are going to have these phone calls, transcribed and taped and things like that. But in terms of physically going through it, I mean, there will be a wealth of information that will help us really try to get at those answers. So, anyways, so. Happy to have more people join us. That's probably a good time to stop now and let everybody go. But Bob, you and I can talk more about this if you have time.
That's a fascinating, it's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah.
And I hope you view the $10 million to really help, direct serious policy in this area. It's really, it may even be the case. So UCLA is having a problem now, as you know, that poor people don't want to leave the hospital.
Yes.
They have a private room, they get served a meal, even with all the annoying doctors and the blood pressures in the middle of the night,